brother. Oh, what's up?
This is a new big party, man.
Yeah, brother, I dig it. Stop right on.
All right. Good morning and welcome to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. And this is happening. It's becoming far too familiar. Coming in here in the morning. Oh, who that goomer?
I'm the guy that's far too familiar.
No, just coming into the studio, it's becoming far too familiar. Good morning, Sandy. How you doing?
Well, I'm all right. How about you?
Man, I'm doing fine. It's it's always refreshing and less challenging coming in the morning when you're here.
Less challenging.
Yeah, less formidable.
Oh, that's I'm an easy mountain to climb.
So how was the weekend?
We did do some fireworks last night. We talked about that last Friday, and
yeah.
I suggested that there might be some illicit pyrotechnics, and it turns out there was.
So I'm sure the grandchildren loved it.
They did. There was it was quite a spectacle. And we listened carefully for sirens. None. There were none.
Did you have them on a barge on the river?
Well, they were next to the river. It was safe. We did it very safely.
Yeah, I know, but you got the river, so I'm figuring you had a big barge set up.
Well, it wasn't that elaborate.
Well, knowing you, it's pretty elaborate, but it had to be. So this is the end of it. You brought up the rear. The end of the fireworks.
Well, we didn't shoot all of them.
So, are you telling me you're gonna shoot some more?
Could happen again.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're at that time. What is it? The middle of July, almost.
Well, Bastille Day is still to be had, right?
Right. Right. So, you know, I remember I haven't been to Bastille Days since I was a young man. You've been on the Bastille Days, and
yeah. It's a pleasant thing to walk. It's a much more pleasant experience than Summerfest. Summerfest is
it's too big,
sprawling, crowded. Yeah, Bastille Days kind of fresh, you know.
Yeah, you know, I have completely forgotten about Bastille Days. When I was younger, it was a must appear event, and I'm glad you mentioned Bastille Days. When is it?
Well, July 14th is Bastille Day, so it's usually around that. I'm sure it's that'd be
this weekend.
Yeah, it's this weekend.
Yeah. Well, I got.
I'm sure it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, that kind of thing.
Well, that's somewhere to go. I mean, I think it's been a while, but I'll be glad to get down there. Always just acquaintance of it, but I'm sure by now it's got to be huge.
It's much bigger. They take more city blocks. There's more food vendors.
More live entertainment.
Yeah, I haven't been there for a couple of years. So
well, yeah, because
I'm not sure they had it during the pandemic.
No, I don't think they had it during the pandemic, but it is, I think, just a great event. It's always been a great event. I'll get a chance to go down and enjoy it. It's always been enjoyable. But I it was something else that I wanted to talk about before we got into the show, and it'll soon come to me. Oh,
it's already come to you.
Yeah. Well, you know, a few months ago, we didn't see a lot of vehicles on these car lots, new car lots.
Mm-hmm.
Sandy, the vehicles are starting to come back. Something is going on in the supply chain. So what is that? I mean, why?
Well, actually, it was interesting. There was an article yesterday about lumber prices. Lumber prices.
Yeah, they're going up.
No, they're going down.
Oh, they're starting to go down.
Oh, no, they plummeted. They're half of what they were a year and a half ago. There was a slight surge. You know, they peaked out in 2021 in the spring. And then 6 months later, there was a little bit of a spike again. And now they're half the price. and the futures of them looked like the price might continue to depress. And people are saying that this is the bellwether, the leading indicator of recession. You know, that this could demonstrate that demand is slacking, and so is this reflects a slacking in demand for new housing, and also there has been a cooling in the real estate market, and so the supply chain undoubtedly will catch up. You know, the economists have said it's sort of a bitter pill, but recession is the cure for shortage.
It's strange you say that, because I was reading something. Here it is in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on yesterday. Inflation means higher construction costs, but downtown Milwaukee apartment developments are still coming thanks to strong demand. So, Sandy, how explain?
Well, construction costs include materials costs,
right,
but they also include labor costs and concrete and a variety of things that might continue to have an inflating price. But lumber, at least, is dropping in price.
Well, it should drop, because it really escalated. I mean, is that what you mean by when you said these are commodities?
Yeah.
And
I mean, commodities are very volatile, and lumber is a commodity. Lumber is probably the most volatile of the commodities associated with construction. So, lumber prices have always been relatively volatile, but what they did a year and a half ago, they tripled actually in the space of about 6 months, and they peaked out in the spring of 2021.
And even at the time that they did that, construction continued. It was a hot market.
Well, a lot of construction. My son was involved in a project, but you know, projects get going; they're contracted, and
they have no choice but
to continue. And it really depends on who has assumed the risk of the lumber price. It could be the contractor, it could be the developer. It really depends on how the contracts are drawn up as to who is going to bear the risk of this volatile lumber price and materials price. But projects continue once they start. They continue either they run amok and go under, or they continue.
Where is it at? You know, Sandy, I'm just flustered, because I know where I wanted to go, and my wife's not here to help me. I had it
all. Am I a surrogate for your wife here? What?
I mean, the way I had to show situate. Oh, here it is. Okay. Here in Waukesha, the jails are overcrowded, and so there's pushback and argument about what to do with all of these prisoners. This is not Milwaukee County; this is Waukesha County.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could help but think, Sandy, is all over these jails and whatnot, they're just crammed with people.
Yeah.
And you always talked about plans. Where is the plan?
Well,
because when you increase, and you say we want to make sure we increase law enforcement and we want to increase sending people to jail, that's easy to say, right? But shouldn't there be some plans?
Well, you'd think we would actually do an analysis of who we incarcerate and who we send to jail. I mean, law enforcement does not require incarceration. You can go to a number of countries, and Norway and almost all of Scandinavia has a much different approach to the handling of crimes, and they actually have a much better result in terms of recidivism, the repeat crimes. So, you know, maybe part of our process is we ought to evaluate
what the crime is.
What crimes require imprisonment. And that clearly was the case. You know, in 1971, we had a surplus of prison space. And in 1990, we had a shortage. And there wasn't much difference, really, in what was going on, or even that much difference in the crime statistics. But we had changed our approach to crime. So we had this three strikes and you're out.
Right.
We had mandatory truth prison sentencing.
No parole.
No parole. We had done all kinds of things that were going to increase the prison population, but not necessarily, they were not necessarily the result of something that was going on in society. And furthermore, all of that crowding of prisons, which was the result of increased incarceration, did not have an impact on a reduction in crime out in society. So maybe we just need to reevaluate how we approach this whole thing.
You know, Sandy, you just took the words out of my mouth. There's nothing with all of that that says things are safer or things are going to get better because we keep locking people up, not to mention the sheer cost.
Well, you know, to some extent, locking people up is sending them to the College of Crime. You know, in the United States, at least, incarceration, everyone understands that that incarceration is not necessarily something that will cause someone to come out of prison
a better person.
A different person right. than they went in. In fact, I think most people believe, if you ask them, that going to prison probably causes you to become a different and potentially more dangerous person.
You know, I think it's either Tuesday or Thursday of this week, I've got some guys who are going to be here who are talking about exactly that, the fact that we've got, what did they used to call it, Sandy? Corrections? Department of Corrections?
Yeah, we have a Department of Corrections. We had a parole. I mean,
So what does corrections mean? Let's challenge what they mean by corrections.
Yeah.
Because it used to be, maybe back from what I used to read about the 50s and things like that, that they would actually do that. They would focus and concentrate on correcting behavior in the prisons.
Yes. I mean, I think prisons used to have, there used to be an intent that people would go to prison and that things would be done to help them change their path
right.
in a more positive manner. And now I think we've decided that prisons are just a place we stash people and keep them out of society until they have to be returned to society. And we've even privatized prisons so that the public can wash their hands of what goes on in the prisons. We can simply create a process where we warehouse people.
Sandy, hold that thought. Got to go to a break. I see you, Al. 844-967-2789 is the number. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. Sandy Williams is here. We'll be right back. So then the next question becomes, a lot of this, is it now because it's a business? I mean, I remember when they put prisons on the New York Stock Exchange back in 30, 40 years ago. Who to sock it to? It's your thing. Do what you want to do. All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. I'm always happy he's here. Let's go to the phone lines. And Mr. Albert Holmes, how you doing, my friend?
Good morning, gentlemen.
What is your thought on, you know, the subject, the fact that we are locking so many people up? Go ahead.
The one thing that you haven't mentioned is the prison industries and the products that they make in the prisons, and those things wind up in the retail stores. It goes everywhere from furniture to Racine Correctional has a shoe manufacturing business where they make work shoes and sell them all over the world. You know, they've got now food. If you go on the internet and look up prison industries, you'll get an alphabetical list of all of the states and their prison systems and what products they make in the prisons. And there was a report a couple years ago about Walmart saying that over 50% of the products that they sell so inexpensively, they buy from the prison industries, which means they're not paying anything for the stuff, and then they make a killing off of it. So there's more to it than just correcting people. It's about putting people in prison to increase their workforce.
So let's look at this. In the state of Iowa, they make walnut plaques, microfiber rag, highly Hingley hand sanitizer, gel, chrome wipes, foaming soap, and hand soap. That's in the Iowa prisons.
And they produce most of the corn that's biologically modified that people are eating.
Sandy, you want to respond to any of that?
I don't. You know, to be honest with you, it's outside my range of knowledge. My concern about the prison industry has not been so much things that are produced within the prison other than the damage they're doing to the character of the people who get sent to prison. Obviously, people who get sent to prison typically have a defect in their character, but I think the view is that people coming out of prison tend not to have been improved in character, but possibly have been damaged. And my understanding of the prison industry that most people are concerned about is the privatized prison industry and the extent to which the governments were paying money to private entities to house the inmates, and that was the prison industry that most people talk about.
I agree with you, Sandy.
This notion that things are made in prison and that people are imprisoned in order to be essentially free labor, to be honest with you, I haven't heard much talk about that. There was a time when prisons were places where people were actually trained to do things, and that training process did involve creating things. So it is true that, for instance, prisons, made a great deal of the furniture that was used in elementary schools, I believe, the desks and things that were, and those came out of prison industry. But the positive side of that was that the people who were in the
prisons
picked
up trades.
Were picking up trades and learning how to do things. So that's a counterpoint to the point you were making. But I am concerned about privatized prison and the extent to which there are lobbyists out there, and I think it was very clear in the 90s that some of the three strikes and you're out, and the reduction in parole and probation abilities were lobbied for by people who had a vested interest in people staying in prison.
Al,
Sandy, I'm not disputing what you're saying. I agree with you, but the point is, I work in the prison. I work with people in the prisons and coming out on fatherhood and parenting and things of that nature. And we just recently received two reports about the benefits of men getting going through fatherhood programs to reconnect with their families, especially their children, and the benefits to that. But it's about, you know, look at the bottom line. The more people they put in prison and the more products they generate in prison, affects the economy, but it also it doesn't get these people the skills that they need to come out and get a job with a felony on their background.
Hey,
family supporting jobs I'm talking about.
Hey, Al, man, thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it. You know, Sandy, he makes valid points, because if you just look at what really happens, if you been incarcerated, and here we are with a shortage of workers, right? And you have a felony on your record. It doesn't matter what the felony is for. Almost 9 times out of 10, you're eliminated from ever working again. For, you know, business people, unless they're shrewd business people, are going to take a look and say, "Well, this guy's got a felony. We're not going to touch him." And I know some people who have felonies who made a mistake when they're young. I don't know, Sandy, why a business person wouldn't say, well, if a person had a felony when they were
18 years old and they're now 25 and they haven't committed any more crimes, why would I hold that felony against them if I see that they have abilities? That kind of mentality still exists in the broader business community. Why?
Well, I mean, I suspect you're right. You do read stories about businesses that have opened themselves to pursuing and working with people who've come out of incarceration. So you can just hope that that view expands, particularly in a period of worker shortage.
Yeah, I would especially think that right now would be a good time because what you do is if people don't wind up with a chance, with an opportunity, what do you think they're going to do, right? You've got the scarlet letter on you. And you're still an adult, and you still have family, and you still want to participate. You're not going to just sit back and starve, right? So yeah. You kind of encourage people to create crimes again. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. Sandy Williams is here. We'll be right back.
Here's what surprises me and makes me scratch my head is that China is dealing with COVID different than the rest of the world.
They're dead serious about it.
They're taking it very, very seriously. They're reporting to the world the fact that a country of 1.3 billion people, they report, you know, that the whole mainland China's had like 80 cases of COVID reported, and they report that as if that's a problem.
Right.
That this entire country, so they are treating COVID like they know something about it that we don't.
You know? Well,
the rest of the world doesn't, because the rest of the world has decided that COVID is a disease that we want to deal with in some fashion, but we aren't going to and aren't trying to eliminate it entirely.
Okay? Well, you know, people.
But the Chinese are dealing with it like they want it to be absolutely eliminated.
Well, people are saying, well, you know, it started there. They ought to know better. I mean, they're the ones who created it. And as if that somehow, you know, has anything to do with what they are attempting to do. It is not. Nobody will say that that's a good thing the way they are taking away people's freedoms.
Well, I mean, actually, I mean, this is a bigger than, I mean, this is something that has implications for China proper, not the people, okay? The lockdown they've done in Shanghai, the lockdown they've done nationally is creating a recession. It's bottling up their economic capability. It's not something that a government, it's basically damage that the government is doing to itself. It's not that they're being tough on the people. They're being tough on themselves as a country. And so then the question is, why are they doing this? And I really scratch my head because I think the world has demonstrated that while COVID is a disease that we need to be concerned about, it's not a disease like smallpox or some horrendous plague.
Well, what they have said, bless you, what they have said, Sandy, is... okay, what they have said is that they are concerned about what's coming, and they want to be prepared. They don't ever again want to wind up on the short end of this, so they're doing prevention.
Yeah,
it's what they're doing. And yet in our country, Sandy, we got people complaining about wearing masks. And again, like you said, 1.3 billion people, and they know the outcome of what will take place if that many people can be affected. And as you stated, 80 cases in a place with 1.3 billion people is nothing, but they know how contagious.
Well, they must be concerned about their public health system being able to make it through a contagion. I mean, they have a level of concern about this that reflects something different than the rest of the world. And I'm not suggesting that they know something about COVID that we don't know, but they have their public health reaction to it suggests that they have a different set of thought processes involved. You know, are they treating each one as a practice for the next pandemic, so that they, or are they believing that the mutation capability of this disease is such that if it gets loose in China, it will continue to mutate in a fashion that will cause it to be perpetual? And that, to me, that's more my suspicion, that they think that in a country with 1.3 billion people, that this disease would evolve while it's spreading throughout the country in such a way that they might never be able to curtail it.
Well, just the thought, Sandy, of 1.3 billion people. And, you know,
well, you know, that number sounds awfully big, but it's only about four times the size of the United States.
Yeah, but that's...
No, but I mean, it's four times our population. It's a landmass that's as big as the United States. So you can picture the United States having twice its population. You can picture
right.
us doubling.
Well, there's
its
more
size.
Than enough land area and mass, but you hear people in this country saying it's not. So from July 17th, Hong Kong will require all COVID-19 patients under home quarantine to wear an electronic bracelet to stop them from leaving their homes. The city's new health minister, Lo Chung Meng, announced Monday. Lo, approved by Beijing last month as part of the new chief executive, John Lee's cabinet, also said Monday that the Hong Kong government recommends to roll out in part the health code adopted in mainland China that prevents COVID patients from visiting public venues and requires mandatory quarantine of overseas visitors. You know, the bottom line is we do know, as you stated, that the fall will be here before we know it. And we know in this country, and we know, and they know in China, that we'll be dealing with COVID again. And as you stated, no telling when we won't be dealing with it, but I'm sure many of the American people think that we're beyond that, and that no thought about COVID ever again. They also stated in this article, Sandy, and you projected it, that the seriousness of it is not as severe. You know, when they contract it, they're saying that this new variant that they're dealing with is going to unfortunately come back again and again and again, and the same person can contract it.
Well, I mean, like the comment, like I said, at some point, this whole disease is going to turn into an endemic disease, meaning something that you have repeatedly, the cold. You know,
right.
You and I have had colds our whole lives.
Right.
Probably get two colds a year, you know. And so, you know, at some point, COVID, it could turn into that. That's the hopeful outcome, and that's probably the most probable outcome. I think news media would do us a favor if what they would concentrate on is not just announcing that China's doing this, but kind of digging in and finding out why China is dealing with it the way they are. Because that's the question that's most interesting to me is, yes, China's doing this, and it's damaging their economy, and it's creating a great deal of proscriptive kind of restrictions on the people of China, and it is minimizing the number of COVID cases in China, obviously.
Right.
And then the question is, why? You know, why has China decided to do this? Because maybe they have good reason, or maybe their reasoning is just simply different than ours, and it's going to be hard to measure who's right.
And it doesn't mean that they're wrong. So I'm saying, Sandy, what we should learn or learn from what we've been through thus far with COVID is, when we figure in, they start saying, well, these things are starting to come up again, and we should be thinking, oh, now it's time to go back to mask. Now it's time maybe to get vaccinated again. Maybe that thought is what we should be thinking as Americans, instead of no more mask. No more vac-. I mean, they're not saying that in China.
Well, and actually our CDC isn't saying that either. But the people, we definitely have mask fatigue, and we've now gone through about 6 months of time where people have rather successfully not worn masks. And our, I think the real issue is what will happen to the health system, what will happen to the hospital system. And what I did hear today, in fact, was that in some localities in the country where the level of COVID cases has gone up rapidly,
yeah.
Hospitalizations had also been going up. Hospitalizations in one region, and I'm just trying to remember whether it was New York or which part of the country it was, had reached the highest level since last February. And so the real problem of COVID, we can measure it in individual cases and say how severe is the individual case. But the real problem on a national basis is the health system.
So,
and what happens to hospitals. And if our hospitals get overcrowded and our health system starts collapsing, we have a national problem.
So do you think we've done our due diligence to increase the system, to strengthen the system since COVID?
Well, I don't know. I can't answer that, but I suspect that our reaction to COVID going forward will answer it for us.
Right.
So, you know, I think...
But we don't want to do it the hard way, do we?
No, we don't. And I think the most important thing is that our health system watch our hospitals and watch our health delivery system and provide that we have a canary in the coal mine telling us that, yeah,
right,
we've got a problem developing here. We better change the way we're relating to COVID. We better go back to masking in certain locales at least. You know, we better make the reaction equal to the problem so that, number one, we deal with the problem, and number two, we don't ask people to do things that are unnecessary.
You know, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. Sandy Williams is in the studio. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. Sandy Williams is here. It's always good to have him here. You know, Sandy, I keep watching these fires. We've always had them. I mean, this is nothing new and unusual, but the intensity of them, the length of them growing, mm-hmm. we see it. The fact that my son lives in Arizona, it's 107 degrees, you know, I mean, it's anybody who thinks climate change is not real. What can we do to get people to understand that's real, Sam?
Well, you know, maybe it seems like there isn't a segue between the subject you were just talking about, which is wearing masks and whether people are, you know, people chafe at the notion that they're going to wear a mask. They figure, well, I'm doing, you know, why should I be told to wear a mask? I won't wear a hat when I go out in the winter. I don't care if I catch a cold. I don't care if
right.
I catch COVID. The reason we ask people to wear masks is so that they protect, because we're protecting the hospital system. We're protecting community health, not individual health.
Right.
And I think the whole problem with global warming is that global warming is a community problem. It's not a personal problem. So if you decide to drive a car, it's like, you know, I'm going to drive a car. It's not going to affect me.
Right. It's my prerogative.
My prerogative. And during my lifetime, I'll be fine. It's not going to be a problem. And so our inability to react to global warming is the same reason we have a lot of trouble deciding to wear masks. And it's the lack of community commitment in the United States. We aren't committed to community welfare. We're committed to our own individual decision-making and our self-interest. And it's community welfare that is at stake with global warming. An individual can say, I don't care if it gets warm. I can still play golf or whatever, the selfish thought is. But if the problem relates to what's going to happen to the world and what's going to happen to our grandchildren or somebody else's grandchildren.
Right.
And so that's community interest. That's different than self-interest. And I think what we have to do in America is we have to do whatever the things are that are necessary to reawaken in people community interest and community unselfishness, community commitment, and get away from just self-interest and self-commitment.
So, Sandy, we as individuals have that problem, but you can also see it with businesses. You look at the corporate farms and what the waste that happens with the corporate farms, and yes, they're making money, but the damage that they're doing, it's like, well, you know, We're business, we're a farm, you know, I mean, we're making money, the people need this, the people need, and they can't see that either.
Well, that's right, and you know, that back to Adam Smith, but I mean, the marketplace is made up of a bunch of self-interested decisions which are supposed to average out to community welfare, but the problem is that some impacts of decisions are not experienced within the market, so it's called external economies, but, you know, like the impact on the environment. The impact on the environment is a huge community of impact, not a self. It isn't experienced by the people who are participating in the marketplace so directly. And so the market doesn't impose limits on it, and that's what regulation is for. That's what the EPA is for. That's what the government is there for, is to regulate those externalities and to make sure that they get reflected and get prescribed as necessary to avoid them. But some businesses are big enough to reflect that community interest. So you'll see that huge businesses, Coca-Cola and others, do talk about, at least give lip service to worry about global warming. They want to recycle. You know, part of the recycling business, the extent some of it was bogus, but it was based on a marketing view that the public in general did care about recycling, and so businesses tried to present themselves to the public as being actively involved in recycling, and I believe that they continue to be, and the more the public holds their feet to the fire, the more they will maybe get real about it.
Well, you know, Sandy, when you've got both individuals and, you know, the citizenry that doesn't see the importance of that, and the business community at times it doesn't see that. I don't see the the time or the place where it's going to be addressed enough, because then we say, even in this country, well, it's not us. We're not as bad as they are somewhere else.
Well,
I think we stop thinking about.
Well, I know there are conservatives who want California out of the United States, but California, for instance, as a jurisdiction, has had a very aggressive approach to global warming, for instance, and they've imposed air restrictions that are more stringent than the rest of the country. And in fact, one of the reasons that our automobiles have more stringent limits on them than the federal government requires is they're meeting the California standards, because California is such a big marketplace. And California's done the same thing with GMO, kind of genetically modified things. They restrict that more. They've worried more about carcinogens in products than the rest of the country. So has the European Union. The European Union standards for all of these things, including the restrictions on carbon and carbon footprint, are substantially more stringent than the United States. So I would say that the problem is a matter of values in the United States, and it's the inability of leadership and political leadership in our country to awaken this community value that can be awakened. It's been awakened in California. It's been awakened in the European Union. And the problem is that in the rest of the United States, we've allowed selfishness and self-interest to be the dominant value instead of the community value. And so that's our problem with masks. It does relate to messaging. We did a terrible job of messaging about COVID as a disease. We instructed everyone to worry about their own personal health instead of helping people understand that what we were worried about was community health and the community health system.
You know, Sandy, you talk about California and the people look at the Californians as kooks. Right? I mean, look at them. Look at what they're doing. The rest of the nation's looking at them as if, you know, those people are out of their minds. But in truth, as you just stated, they're on point. And yet the rest of us, and you talk about messaging, all of these things at the root of them are messaging. I remember, as well as you, I'm sure you remember, and those in our generation, when my parents and I was a kid, all the garbage went into the cans, the bottles, the glass, everything went into one. The garbage, all of it went into one thing. Now, you know, there are very few people, if any, who don't separate those things.
Well, that's true. But also as a kid, our milk bottles went back to be refilled with milk. Our Coke bottles went back to be refilled with Coke. There weren't tin cans for soda. It was all in bottles that were recycled, and you got paid. You could, if you were a kid, you could go out and collect bottles and get 3 cents a
bottle
to get them when you returned them. And so there were built-in things that were minimizing. I mean, yes, we weren't handling garbage as carefully, but we also were not per capita creating anywhere near the mountain of garbage and waste that we currently create. You know, when you went to the hardware store, things were in bins, and you'd reach in
and pick
out a wrench, and it wasn't in a bubble wrap, plastic, separate wrap with cardboard and plastic and the rest of it. So, you know, our world has evolved, and we've evolved in this way that makes every one of us far more damaging to the environment than every one of us was in 1950.
So we're not saying that evolution is not important. Nobody's going to advocate, you know, the plow for the horse and buggy. I mean, the plow for a tractor.
Yeah.
That's never going back there, Sandy. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't take these things seriously and into consideration. And unfortunately, that's what I'm saying is we don't. Everything doesn't have to be the way it is.
Well, I think I just think messaging and values. I think the American value system is defective. It's reflected in our lack of a social safety net. I mean, I keep repeating this. It's reflected in our lack of daycare for kids. It's reflected in our lack of attention to education. And it's reflected in our lack of health care for people. These are all community interests and the interests of those around us, right? Not self-interest. And it's also reflected in the way we've messaged COVID and the way we've dealt with COVID, and it's dealt with in the way we deal with global warming and our lack of community drive. Our value system in America needs to be reinstructed and redirected.
So when we come back, I want to talk with you about the self-interest. Who turns that around? How do we turn around Americans who become comfortable in their own skin and can't see anything beyond their own? That's a big ask. And who begins to do that? Got to go to a break. Sandy Williams is in the studio. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back. So we know that. You talk about it.